imagine there's no heaven. Sees if you try.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Matthew DeClaire, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought, the show that promotes and defends scientific naturalism, humanism, and critical thinking to encourage progressive social change. As some of you may know, I'm currently a graduate student at Columbia Journalism School here in New York, pursuing a Master of Arts in Science Journalism. The interview you're about to hear was conducted for a class assignment, but that certainly doesn't make it any less interesting. The assignment was to conduct an oral history on someone who was related to our theses or our concentration. After reaching out to some people for ideas, I chose Dr. Niles Eldridge. Dr. Eldridge is a paleontologist who served as a curator at the American Museum of Natural History from 1969 until 3 years ago. He's well known for his once controversial and now widely accepted evolutionary theory of punctuated equilibria, which he developed with Stephen Jay Gould. He's the author of many books, including The Pattern of Evolution, Life in the Balance, Why We Do It, and Darwin, Discovering the Tree of Life. I interviewed Dr. Eldridge at his home in Ridgewood, New Jersey. I began the interview by introducing him and referred to his theory as punctuated equilibrium. He responded with a passionate correction, saying that the theory is punctuated equilibria. So, I asked the most basic question I can think of, and that is where I will leave you. Enjoy. What's the importance of the distinction to you?
Well, it's punctuated. I've always called it punctuated equilibria. It was Steve's term. It was the original title of the paper, you know, punctuated equilibria, an alternative to phyletic gradualism. I never saw a need to change it.
That's interesting because most of the places that I looked tended to call it equilibrium.
Oh, I know.
Why does that? Why do you think that? That happened. Does it just sound better to people?
I mean, in my more paranoid moments, I think Steve tried to appropriate the whole thing, but I don't know. I think it was not done consciously on his part. I mean, we were friends and we remain friends. We never really had any bad times. But on the other hand, why the hell would he do that? And then deny it to me? His big complaint about other people was they don't read, you know. He wrote that. And he claims he didn't remember it. So,
what would have been the purpose, in his mind, for making the change?
I refer to you to the answer just given. You know, it's just that's my more paranoid moments. I don't know. I don't think it was just a mistake. I don't know.
Let's go all the way back.
Sure.
All the way back before Stephen Jay Gould.
Right.
Before college.
Right.
You grew up in Brooklyn, New York, right?
No, I was born in Brooklyn, grew up in Queens for three years, and then moved to New Rochelle. And by the time I was four and a half, five, moved to East Chester, New York. That's where I actually went to high school and went through the whole school system and everything. So.
And what was did you have any particular topics that you were interested in at the time in high school that you can remember? Or were you just kind of going through high school as many of us do?
I was a language person.
Language?
Yeah. Latin and French.
And I read somewhere that you had taken a number of trips to the American Museum of Natural History.
As a little kid?
As a child, I think is how it was phrased. You can tell me if that's accurate or not.
Yeah, we were living in the burbs, and my father's sister, who was a little older than she, he was younger than she. Her name was Virginia, Aunt Jenny, and she was living in the city. And so I would get on the train all alone and go down, and she'd pick me up at Grand Central on the right platform, and we'd always go straight to the museum.
What do you remember about the Museum of Natural History?
The wolves.
The wolves.
Yeah, because those are the first things you see of any substance back in the old days on the subway entrance level. So I remember the wolves and, of course, the dinosaurs and so on. But the whole Megillah. There was a different whale and a different whale hall at that point. You know, I remember the whale. It was this stuff, but it was the usual stuff, you know.
Yeah, I can imagine that people who were looking at your history and hearing you ever talk about your visits to the American Museum of Natural History, obviously that would seem to be something that people would automatically say, oh, this must have been where it started for you. Do you think that's true at all?
Well, partially. I mean, I think that in fourth grade, we had a unit on dinosaurs, which I was particularly intrigued with, but so were everybody. All the other kids, or most of the other kids in fourth grade. I did do a lot of fishing, and my father was interested in just hiking in the woods and finding strawberries and stuff. So we were outside a lot and doing things like that. None of these things, actually, any one of them would sort of add up to a... So I don't know. I mean, I was interested in, I didn't know what to do. And I always tell kids, you know, so what do you think you're going to do? And they say, oh, I don't know. I say, well, that's good, you know, because particularly when you go to college, you should look around, you know. So, you know, I got to wrap on that. But we could probably get to that. I don't know. But I got interested in evolution in the eighth grade. I remember that was the case, but only ex post facto. And I read a couple of books and stuff. But again, I mean, I don't remember having any sort of a real sort of passion to go there. I mean, I don't know. I thought I was going to be a lawyer after I got out of college. Hmm. So
at what point did you end up transitioning from your interest in the languages to actually pursuing courses?
Okay, this is almost, I hope this doesn't sound like a set piece, but this is something that I've gone into. I went to college, I went to Columbia, and I decided first to stay and become an academic, you know, and not be a lawyer or anything else. But I was starting out as a Greek and Latin major. I never got to Greek. And I was in over my head to start off in the first semester of freshman year with a very tough Latin course. It was on elegiac poetry, for heaven's sakes. And anyway, I did pretty well, and I liked it. But I met my wife, but she wasn't married to me at that point. She was a freshman at Barnard, and we met at the Columbia Barnard Jazz Club. So anyway, and she knew a lot of faculty members out in Leonia, New Jersey. It was a bedroom community, probably still is, for Columbia. And she particularly knew a bunch of anthropologists. And so I got to meet some of them, including Marvin Harris, who actually I regard as my basically intellectual role model. And so he's a cultural anthropologist. And at the same time, I started getting into, now how did I get into geology? I took geology to do a science requirement because I thought of myself as a non-scientist. Some people still do. And that's supposed to be a joke. And anyway,
I think we're getting to that later.
I took geology as a sophomore and collected my first fossils, and amongst which were the things that I worked on for my PhD and later on down the pike. And so then I went off and went to Brazil on one of the most important experiences of my life for 2.5-3 months down in Brazil in the summer of 63. Doing cultural anthropology but collecting fossils out of the so-called reef that was forming a natural harbor for the fishing boats in the fishing village that I was in, and came back and started taking paleo courses. So I went basically from a language orientation to a anthropology orientation, but and it was by only my last semester at Columbia that I finally got more credits in geology than I had in anthropology. So I basically pushed both of those things. But I decided that the fossils were the thing, and there you go. So.
And so the fossils that you ended up working on, for the most part, are those guys back there, that picture you have, trilobites.
Yeah, this is from Ohio. That's one of the signal. That's Phacops rana, so-and-so. And from the Devonian of Ohio and Middle Devonian. And that's one of the sort of punctuated equilibria specimens, yeah.
So tell me about those guys. What are they?
Oh, well, they're very primitive arthropods. They have, in life, they would have had a pair of antennae coming out like this. And let me see if I can remember. Three pairs of legs under the head. One pair of legs associated with each of these 11 flexible segments so they can roll up like a ball. And then a few more underneath the tail, which is a fused, sort of this kind of a thing fused into a tail. And the primitive arthropods, they started in the base of the Cambrian, and they ended up sort of gasping out at the end of the Paleozoic.
And so for people who have either no idea what they are, or maybe they know what they are, but they don't know too much about their significance or importance, why these guys? Why did you end up studying
them? Well, actually, I started working on snails first, because I had a mentor at the museum and the Columbia faculty, Roger Batten, who was a snail guy. So I was working on snails, and I published some stuff on snails. And my wife, Michelle, she prefers collecting snails. They're gorgeous, and she had a knack for finding those things. But I picked trilobites. I have a friend of mine who we still visit, and he's retired now too. He said, well, you know, come on up to the Middle Devonian of New York and I'll show you some stuff. But trilobites are complex. You can see that there's a lot of anatomy here. So if you're going to study evolution in space and in time, best way to get about it is to look at some anatomy that is complex enough. You think that maybe if they are evolving, you should pick up some change pretty easily in them. You know, in snails, you can describe a snail with three mathematical statements and the way they grow and everything. And they're kind of, it's one integrated genetic complex of the whole body, and it just goes around and around. So some of the aspects of the shell anatomy can be a little bit complicated, but they're not as complex as this. So I figured it'd be better to work on stuff that's more complicated, more complex. So.
And so you did that relatively early when you were in college?
Not in college, it was graduate school.
Graduate school, sorry, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you ended up writing your PhD,
right?
What was that process like? And where did you begin? What was the initial idea that you had? Was it very specific, or did it change over time?
No, it didn't change very much. I picked this particular species. And I was aware that it was relatively easy to collect and that it was distributed for about, we thought then 8 to 10 million years. Now it's more like 6 to 8 million years through time. And it also occurs in sediments, haphazardly, but occurs in sediments from the Appalachians, so upstate New York running down to Virginia, but all the way out to Iowa. So, and southern Canada down to Alabama or whatever, so. A pretty good geographic range, and I was aware that there was a renewed appreciation, I would say now renewed, but a new, relatively new appreciation for the importance of geography and evolution. And another thing about these guys is that invertebrates, they occur in numbers, if they occur at all. So they're not like fossil vertebrates, which are one specimen. So, you know, traditionally, evolutionary-minded people who were paleontologists worked on vertebrates, you know, fish and dinosaurs and what mammals, but it was all comparative anatomy and so forth. And what we were now looking at was sample sizes and, you know, getting sort of statistically meaningful samples. And you know, the rocks of certain places are basically just made out of the skeletons of these things. And so the sampling is a lot easier with invertebrate fossils than it is with vertebrates.
How did your PhD end up? How did you feel about it?
Well, it gave me my whole life. It gave me, you know, ultimately the basis of my career and the house that we're sitting in right now and kids' college educations and stuff. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Some people have said to me, well, you keep saying the same old stuff. Well, as long as it sells, that's all right with me. And anyway, it was regarded as radical. It was, in the context of its times, radical. But it had enough plausibility all along and enough people saying, yeah, you know, you're right and whatever. So that was the way to go.
When did you realize that you were on to something in the process of putting together your PhD?
Well, again, in a sense, this is an oft-told story, but I realized they wasn't seeing any evolution in my trilobites, you know. And I think I actually did, innocently. I found an undergraduate essay that I wrote, and I participated in a seminar that with the entry graduate students, one of whom was Steve Gould. And so they allowed me to hang out and give a paper. And I actually am putting that online now. That it's kind of interesting because I knew about the geography side of things then. But still, we were looking for, we figured that the sample sizes and the statistics would bear out, and careful sampling through time would bear out the basic Darwinian picture of gradual evolution through time. And I knew that I wasn't getting that. And, I mean, I often say it's an oft-told tale, but I was in a laundromat in Alpena, Michigan with my wife, and pulled a specimen out of my pocket and just said, geez, it looks exactly like everything else I've ever seen. And I don't know what the hell's going on here. So anyway, I went home, measured the hell out of everything, cranked them through the new computers that were on the Columbia campus, and still wasn't coming up with a heck of a lot. So it was when I realized that there was stuff going on in the eyes that and I just was doing that, not out of desperation, but because somebody who was a couple of years ahead of me in Scotland, England, can't remember, he's taught all his life in Edinburgh, I think he's British, but, well, he's British, and Ewan Clarkson, and I started emulating his way of counting up the eye facets, and then he had a handy, nifty little way of notating this stuff, and then I started doing that with my guys, and I realized, like, for instance, this one behind me has got 18 columns of lenses in the eyes, and it always does, both sides and everything. And the other one around here, closer in, has got 17. It's not a big change, but it's a difference, you know. So then I started seeing that and putting it on a map and doing time and space, and that's when I knew I had something. That was very exciting, actually.
Yeah, I can imagine, especially because it's something that other people hadn't really thought of before. And it seemed to go against what we had thought at the time. I kind of wonder if when you first proposed that, okay, I think I have an answer to this problem, I kind of wonder what the immediate response was, at least from people like, for example, your advisor.
Thank you. Roger Batten didn't like it at all. A lot of people didn't like it. Now, the older one, Norman Newell, the more famous one, was a little bit less standoffish about it. But it was, as Steve Gould eventually said, pretty soon, this is paleontology's trade secret. Everybody knows that you don't see that kind of pattern of evolution in the rocks. What I've just found out in the last 10 years, amazing. Darwin knew it too. And he was perplexed. He at one point, he just sort of rhetorically asks, he's like 29 years old. He's writing his notebooks, his first really overt transmutational notebooks. He says, maybe Mr. Lonsdale has some examples from the Silurian, you know. Well, Mr. Lonsdale didn't, you know. So,
tell me a little bit more about the response of your advisor. It sounds like there is definitely some interesting story behind that.
Well, you know, it's hard to say. It was a Saturday afternoon or maybe late in the morning. He calls me up. And he was living out here in New Jersey. We were in Westchester. And he says, I'm having trouble with this. And there's this and that. And it wasn't really just about this I don't know. But he wasn't getting it. And I was so I was disheartened, but I was also angry. So we took a long walk in Eastchester over to some of the reservoirs and stuff, and I was ranting and raving and stuff. It was very frustrating because I thought, well, maybe it's not going to go down. But I don't know. Then I talked to him on Monday, and he backed off and whatever. I don't know. I don't have anything really terribly penetrating to say about that. I was freaked out. Scared the hell out of me. But again, because you're trying to produce something that shows that you're capable of doing a legitimate piece of scientific research. And, you know, if the reaction is, oh, this can't possibly be it, and I think you're wrong. I had a lot of people tell me I was wrong. You know, one guy who turned out to be in the administration of the museum after I was a young curator there told me I was just dead wrong. A lot of people just told me I was dead wrong about things.
Did they ever tell you why you were dead wrong?
They just told me I was dead wrong. But they were wrong, you know.
It just sounds very, I would say, unscientific.
Science is done by human beings, and people have emotions, and people say stupid things all the time. You know, I do. And so why should I be alone?
You're right. These are people that we're dealing with. Yeah. And it's not just some overarching, wonderful, perfect, beautiful thing. There's also a lot of interpersonal relationships.
All right.
I'll
tell you two things about this. Steve Gould said, he tried to keep the idea out there, which was great. You know, it's really, so every once in a while we do a where are we now type of paper. And one of them just made that point. At first, everybody says you're crazy, you're wrong. And then they say, well, some people, I can't remember the three-point syllogism, but in the end they say, well, we knew it all the time. So. But my it was embarrassing, it was almost humiliating. It was a Sigma Xi lecture I gave up at an IBM installation in northern Westchester County back in the 80s or something. And I was up there, a little nervous about talking. So I had a bunch of mathematicians, chemists, and physicists, and God knows whoever else out there in the audience. And I said, literally, virtually this, I said, you know, to you guys, it's going to sound weird, but, you know, there's all sorts of arguments going on in evolutionary biology and lots of, you know, fighting and everything. And the whole audience erupted in laughter because that's what physics and chemistry is too. But my sort of model in my head, you know, you make an equation or something and it's QED and everybody falls, you know, it's not the way it is. So, you know, but that laughter was very refreshing to me once I got over being horribly embarrassed, you know, by being so naive. But anyway, but I learned something from that. So,
when did you start at the American Museum of Natural History?
1969, which was the year I got my PhD. In fact, I started a couple of months before the PhD came through. I was very lucky. I was out there, as usual, there weren't too many jobs, and there were some possibilities and so forth, but I'm a New Yorker. I didn't want to go anywhere, and Norman Newell just walked up to me. We were putting in the Hall of Earth History, which doesn't exist anymore, and at the museum. And so he was the honcho for that, and I was helping him out with the trilobites and a few other things. And he walked up behind me and he says, how'd you like to stay here? And I said, duh.
How long were you there for?
41 years. I mean, I had been
pretty good.
I had an office since 64. I just relinquished my office 2.5 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago now. And because they hired a replacement, and I haven't been going in, and it was a little bit of sadness to not have a desk at the museum for almost 50 years. But so I'm not denying that there's a little bit of that. But on the other hand, it's time to move on, and I'm glad they hired somebody, and they need the space, and so life goes on. So it's good, you know.
What was some of your favorite experiences while you were at the Natural History Museum.
Well, you know, our first and foremost obligation was to do publishable scientific research, which is a terrific job to have, you know. And there's other things that are considered valuable, like, you know, helping to do exhibitions, well, certainly taking care of the collections and adding to the collections and so on and so forth. But pretty much, in my better days, you know, we all have ups and downs, but I felt that going back to my Latin classes, that's where I learned about patrons, and I thought that I had the ideal job because museum, in a sense, was my patron. They gave me a salary, which was always adequate, and bennies and all the rest of it, and encouragement, but otherwise left me alone and told me just to go out and do good work, you know. So that's almost like Mozart or some of these Latin poets that I was, Horace, you know, who had wealthy benefactors who just said, do your best and get out there. I mean, it's not always an easy life to even to have a patron. But on the other hand, and it wasn't always quite that simple, but at its best, that's what it was. And it's phenomenal. So one of the things I liked the best, I don't know, I just did a lot of, I got into the trilobites more, I got into fossil horseshoe crabs, but it was really evolution that I really cared about the most. And I don't know. So there's a lot of evolutionary theory. We started getting very abstract in the 1980s. And again, my work was mostly with colleagues who were outside of the building, not inside the building. So Elizabeth Verba, in addition to Steve, and other people, you know. So we did that. I did do two exhibits. I did the whole of biodiversity, which is still there, which still needs better lighting, but otherwise it's great. And then we did the Darwin Show, which was easily my most interesting experience in my later career at the American Museum of Natural History. And I feel very fortunate that they gave me that opportunity. It was a little scary. I'm not a historian. I'm one now. But, you know, I, you know, so that was an eye-opener. And it was a very successful show. It's still traveling the world and so on.
If there is a way that you can explain this, what was a work day like?
Oh, well, practice makes perfect. We did a children's book as part of a series called A Day in the Life of a Subway Man, A Day in the Life of a Fireman. So we did A Day in the Life of a Curator. And so what is the day like? Well, you know, it's a work-a-day thing. So it shows me walking into the museum with a briefcase and walking by some exhibits and going up to my office, you know. So in many ways, it's a perfunctory day, and there's routine things. There's phone calls, you know, and some days you do more work than others. Some days you just schmooze with your friends. I mean, I don't know, but you have a project going, or at least one, you know, so you spend some time before you get eye strains looking down a microscope at specimens, you know, or walking down the hall and getting specimens photographed and stuff like that. So, and reading. And talking to people, because it really is, for me, all about ideas as much as concrete, hard, factoid-type analysis, you know? Sometimes you're off on special projects. Sometimes you're doing an exhibit. As I say, I only did two important ones anyway while I was there. But those are, they can be very intense and so on. Somehow the days and months pass, and then the years pass, and it all adds up, you know. So, and a lot of writing, of course. And you don't know what you don't know until you start writing. You probably know this as a writer. So.
You mentioned Stephen Jay Gould at the beginning, and I think it would be foolish of me not to ask at least a little bit about him. When did you first meet him?
He came to Columbia in the graduate program with another six or so. It was a wonderful group of people that wanted to be paleontologists and stratigraphers, which is the study of layered rocks. Came to the geology department in the fall of 1963, and I think I'm right about that. So he was 2 years ahead of me, because I started in the same program in the fall of 65. And they let me hang out with them. I remember in the spring of 64, we all went down and collected fossils along the shores of Chesapeake Bay. Phenomenal stuff. And just hanging out and having a good old time and staying in $4 motels and eating at church all-you-can-eat dinners and stuff and collecting these phenomenal, rich, beautiful fossils and talking, you know. So I knew him then. We didn't have the seminar that I was remembering until early in 65, so I was a senior in college, but they let me participate in that. So anyway, I knew these guys, and I was a wannabe paleontologist already. I had just gotten back from Brazil, and so I hung with them. So I knew Steve since the fall of 63, if I'm right about it. I think I am right about that. So,
for those of you just tuning in, I'm Matthew DeClaire, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI 99.5 FM. Today I'm presenting an interview I conducted a few weeks ago with Dr. Niles Eldridge, a paleontologist who served as a curator at the American Museum of Natural History for over 40 years. He is known for his once controversial, but now widely accepted, evolutionary theory of punctuated equilibria, which he developed with Stephen Jay Gould. Now, we get into Dr. Eldridge's relationship with Gould. Punctuated equilibria.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. That is often attributed to Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge.
That's right.
What was the connection between you two that that produced this paper?
And first of all, I was a senior author of that paper. And the stories have been told not just by me, but by David Sapkowski's got this out with documentation too. But I'll just tell you what it is. I had worked up a paper about the importance of geography and allopatric speciation, which is geographic speciation that Meyer and particularly Dobzhansky developed a decade before, well, a generation before we came along, geneticists and systematists guys. And I was working on my thesis and realizing that things are not evolving this way. They're evolving sort of laterally and then persisting and so on. And I wrote up a paper that was published in Evolution in 1971. I sent it to Steve in 1970, and he was at Harvard by that time, and I was just starting out at the museum. And I asked him for his comments, and then I think it was 70 or 69, whatever, and he says, what happened was there was a symposium with a book associated to it being planned that Steve very much wanted to be part of. And he wanted to do the topic of morphology was there and phylogeny, but also speciation. And those were the only three sort of explicitly evolutionary topics. And phylogeny had already been grabbed by Mike Gieselin, and Dave Raup had morphology. So Steve and Tom Schaff, who was running the project, said, no, they're taken. Those guys are going to do the job. You can't have those things. The only thing you can have is speciation. And Steve wrote me and he says, you have to join me on this because the only thing I can think of is what is in your paper.
Hmm.
Yes.
It sounds like a lot less had to do with him than you.
It did.
Yeah.
A lot less.
What happened in terms of the public perception of this theory?
It's really hard to say, but the secret of Steve's success is still hard for me to completely, but he's just out there and he's a good communicator, you know? And so I don't know. I think that's why it was not ah, because it was like he was trying to steal from us himself because he had the original title and then, but that, I don't know. Not steal, but expropriate or have it be identified more with him. It's hard to say. I have no real, you know, deep regrets, but yes, a lot of people think it's Steve's stuff, you know, in the book that, I heard from the editor today that it's going to get final approval at the Columbia board on Wednesday that comes out. It's called Eternal Ephemera. And the subtitle is Adaptation and the Origin of Species, 1801, since 1801. And punctuated equilibrium is just part of that, you know. And it turns out Darwin had actually figured it all out when he was 29 years old. But nobody knew that. And Darwin scuttled it. He didn't publish it for various reasons, you know. So the book that I've produced, in a sense, I'm embarrassed, but I just decided to just lay it all out. So, and the museum is putting online the documents, but that essay that I wrote as an undergraduate, and then a couple of sort of other essays I wrote as a graduate student that I never tried to publish, and then this thing that ended up in Evolution, and then the Punky paper. There is one thing that David Sepkoski's published already. I got one of the drafts of the Punk Geek paper. Steve added a lot to the front end and the back end, you know, mostly about the philosophy of science and stuff. And the stuff that I wrote was there in the middle. And it comes back with a title, which is the title, which is good. And I guess we had spoken about it over the phone. I don't know. And but with him as senior author. And the deal we actually had was, he said to me, which was largely true, if somewhat painful, he said, you don't like to give speeches, so I'll be the senior author of the abstract, which was the stupidest thing he ever did, and give the speech in Washington at the GSA meeting, and you be the senior author of the paper. Well, nobody gives a damn about talks and abstracts and stuff, you know. So I said, great, that's fine. I don't want to give the paper in front of 2,000 people in a ballroom in Washington, D.C. I stood in the very back and listened to it, you know, with some friends. You know, I was very happy I wasn't up there trying to present this stuff, you know. So, but anyway, then he walked into my office. I tell the story in the book. But he walked into my office while the publication process was in the works. About 6 months later, and so my little tiny office at the museum, and he says, you know, I think I should be the senior author of this paper. And as I say in the book, I can't remember exactly what I had choked, and I think I said, okay. He's like an older brother, and he's a very dominant guy. So that night, Steve and his wife Debbie and Michelle and I went to the Thalia Theater and saw two Bergman movies and ate some indifferent Chinese food, whatever. And then I could see them at 96th Street Station. Michelle and I were going back to New Jersey. So we were on the northbound platform and they were on the southbound platform because they were going to Queens, I guess. Anyway, they were going to stay with one of their sets of parents. I don't know. And but fortunately, Steve didn't have to go back to Harvard that next day. So he came back into the museum and he walked into my office. And I remember, I just felt almost like jumping out of the railroad tracks. I thought that was the stupidest thing I had ever done in my life. And I felt very bad about it. I was freaking out. He walked into my office and he said, I'm the senior author of the paper. He says, okay, don't get excited. So.
You mentioned not really enjoying public speaking.
I've had periods, particularly after the invention of PowerPoint, where I've been comfortable at it and going around, particularly in South America, and doing speeches about Darwin in South America and things like that. I'm almost always good at it, but I'm nervous beforehand. I mean, one of the most recent things I did was in a high school down here where one of our granddaughters, and I was nervous very nervous, and it seems silly, but I don't know. So, I mean, after I retired, I started getting more anxious about these things. Like, my status wasn't the same, and so on. So, I've had periods when I've felt fine about it, and I've had periods when I've been scared out of my mind, and usually it's somewhere in between, and I don't enjoy doing it, although I almost always do well.
I guess maybe that's why you've done so much writing then?
I don't know. Marvin wrote a lot, and Steve wrote a lot. So in a sense, and I also do think that the history of evolutionary theory is told through books. Now, how many of my books were really contributing to pushing things along? Not too many. I mean, mostly it's been in papers. And then the other books have been about the environment, about creationism, or, you know, evolution for the masses type of thing. Not that the masses ever end up buying my books. But anyway, so why do I write so much? It's a way to figure things out. I said that to you before. You know, you don't know what you don't know until you start writing it down. And I had another professor who basically said that too. So it's good discipline. But it's something to do. It's what I do. You know, I'm finishing three books right now, and I can't wait to finish them. On the other hand, I'm wondering what the hell am I going to do now that they're over, you know? So.
I really want to get to creationism.
Okay.
I had heard this argument coming from creationists before I really began to look into what evolution even was.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I often heard from them is the idea of stasis in the fossil record as being evidence against evolutionary theory.
Right.
Does that tie in directly to the theory of punctuated equilibria, or is it...
No, they just gave them some more what they thought was ammunition, you know. I can't even begin to paraphrase this now, but Reagan talked to Ronald Reagan, I think in the... His first campaign was in Texas at a conservative Christian convention, you know. And so he was a featured speaker. And he said, well, evolution is just a theory. It's only a theory. And some scientists are now saying it's not as true as they once believed. And those lines, or something like that, and those lines were written by Luther Sunderland, who was a very clever man. He was an aerospace engineer for General Electric upstate in Schenectady. Built and flew his own airplanes and everything. But he was I knew him, and I came to respect him, even like him a little bit, but he was a dirty, underhanded guy, you know. And he wrote those words with Reagan's speechwriters, you know, and he had Eldridge and Gould in mind. And so that was, well, I don't know how we feel about it. We didn't like it, but on the other hand, wow. They're talking about it, you know. So, yeah, because that was a syllogism. So Darwin said that evolution is slow, steady, and gradual. These guys are saying, no, there's no evidence for evolution being slow, steady, and gradual. So therefore, they are against Darwin, which means that they are against evolution. That was the logic of that, if such there was logic in what Reagan said, you know. So.
Well, I know in the debate about climate change, and I don't like using the word debate, but unfortunately in politics, it seems to go that direction. I know that very often people who deny that climate change is happening will refer to one point of evidence to make a suggestion about the overall claim right. That climate change is happening. So if I'm getting this straight, you first published this paper. Many scientists don't agree with it, or to put it simply, don't like it. And then you have creationists who are co-opting it for their own purposes.
Right.
What was going on in your mind at the time? Because it sounds like incredibly difficult.
Well, it was, but it was also stimulating. And that's where Steve really was shined, because he thrived on stuff like that, you know. And first of all, neither one of us had a difficulty in telling a creationist apart from our fellow scientists. And we realized they had different motives for feeling this way. You know, it's really, now this, I'm actually going to throw you a curveball, but one thing I just found out in the last decade is that the original question in evolutionary biology, starting with Lamarck, but also this guy Brocchi in Italy, and then Darwin's mentors in Edinburgh, was a non-miraculous explanation for the origin of the species of the modern biota. And they all believed, except for Lamarck, that species were stable. So we're just throwbacks. They knew the species were stable, but they would replace each other in time, and presumably there was a non-miraculous explanation for that. And that's all we did. We were doing that, you know, because even if you read Meyer and Dobzhansky and geographic speciation, which is absolutely essential to our thinking, if they hadn't done that, we wouldn't have, I don't know what the heck would have happened, you know. But even those guys think or thought back in the 30s and 40s that once new species split geographically, then they sort of meander on through time just the way Darwin said that they would. Well, they don't, you know. So, but people back in the 1820s knew that. That blows my mind, you know. So it gives me a lot of comfort now, too. Now, that's a curveball because what I'm doing is stepping aside. You're saying, how did you feel about it at the time? And I had some friends. The editor from Columbia Press, Patrick Fitzgerald, is out at the GSA meetings, wherever they are. And I remember one GSA meeting a couple of years after we published our 72 paper. And he's a conodont micropaleontologist named Gil Clapper. And Gil walked up. I never met him before. He was at the University of Iowa then. And he walked up to me and he said, "You guys are right." I said, "Hey, good to know you." You know, "How you doing?" And he's still a friend, you know. But I can count on the fingers of one hand the number of people said stuff like that, you know. And then a lot of the people said, "You guys are just dead wrong." But they're just spouting what they learned, you know. They didn't have any evidence, you know. So even people who gave it a good, honest, scholarly shot at refuting our stuff, a lot of them came around and just said, "Well, you guys are right." So it's always heartwarming for me to hear that, you know, because did I ever have any moments of doubt and uncertainty? I thought maybe sometimes I was pushing it too much. And you do wonder if you're sort of making up a story and you're so enamored with a story, or your kids' tuition payments are contingent upon the story being still current or whatever and saleable. So you worry about that. And I do know that we, because I've seen people older than I'm 70 now, I'm, you know, insisting that they were right all along. I mean, George Simpson ended up denying continental drift, and he hated punctuated equilibrium. He hated, you know, stuff. You can't do that. You have to be aware that there's going to be stuff coming along that it's going to change the picture, you know, sometimes radically, sometimes not, you know. The fact that we didn't know it, but we were inadvertently changing the picture back to a picture that was held in the 1820s makes me feel good, not bad, because it makes it more true to me. You know, and in a sense, we've been living a lie. And not a lie, but Darwin decided to hop the other way.
You said that you were working on three books right now.
Right.
What exactly is the, do you have the topics about for each individual book?
Well, part of this is pure, in fact, it's largely accidental that they're coming together at the same time. The first book, the one that's really the most important to me, is almost twice as long as any other book I've ever written, and this is the one, Eternal Ephemera. And it's the story, in a sense, of my life, but it's the story of the history of thinking about species and what they are and how and the role they play and what their relationship is to the process of adaptation. I mean, if you look at a guy like Dawkins, I admire Richard very much, but he has a theory of adaptation. That's what Darwin ended up with. He threw out everything else. But if species are real things, and particularly if they're stable things, where does adaptation fit into the picture? So that's what the book is all about. It's taken me probably 3 years to get to this point where it's about to ready to go into production, I hope. And, excuse me, so that's that. And that's basically my life's work. The other book, though, is equally, not equally important, but almost equally important, is a book I did with Sid Harenstein about New York City environment and New York as a microcosm of the world's cities and how the world's cities are, in the same breath, they are the world's worst examples of environmental annihilation, you know, and destruction, but also the last best hope for biodiversity in the world, because that's where the money and the knowledge and the science and so forth, education is concentrated, not unilaterally, but, you know, pretty much. So we try to, it's like a yin and yang of the whole thing. So that book, we started to do that after we finished the Hall of Biodiversity in 1995. We proposed doing an exhibit at the museum. It was actually passed committees, but there was no funding for it, so we never did it. And we sold a book idea, never wrote the book, we never finished it, now we finished it. So it's been a long time. but it just happens to be going out now. I mean, it's coming out of the University of California Press, and I think it's going to be a great book. So anyway, there's that. So I was working on that today. And while there's a little break in the action, and then meanwhile, the third book is a book that is surprisingly fairly well written. It's a book I did called Fossils, and it's really got some great photographs of fossils in it. So I wrote The Glue, but actually if you read the text, not bad, but it's out of date, so I've been updating it. So, but that was just a sort of a very late entry into the thing, and I'm just trying to, you know, and they all due on November 1st, so what the hell? Yes.
No, oh, November 1st.
Yeah. What's the rush? I mean, one of them has been out there for 13 years. It's something like, what's the rush? So, in fact, the form that it's in, the University of California Press, and I have to say, we're publishing pretty much the form that it was in a year ago, but we had some difficulties, and which sometimes happens in the publishing process. So, but we're proud of that book, and it's good. So anyway, if it's a couple of days late, what's the rush?
You had left the American Museum of Natural History, your office, about 3 weeks ago, you said?
Yeah, 3 weeks ago.
How's it been?
Oh, I've been busy. I've been very busy. As I say, I was embarrassed that I had not been going in, and the office was kind of trashed. And then people were starting to use it for summer program this last summer. So it had to be cleaned up a little bit, and that was good. And then, but I didn't want to just walk away without checking all of my files and everything. Fortunately, the library has taken most of my stuff, so that's great, you know. And so it's been done in an orderly manner. So I was vastly relieved when I left, because I felt guilty that I was not doing my job and getting that place cleaned up and looked after. But once it was done, and I was relieved, but, you know, then I started saying, oh, this is the first time in 49 years I don't have a desk, you know, at the American Museum of Natural History. But truth be known, even if I did, I wouldn't use it. So this is a desk right here, you know. And I love the modern era, the digital era. I can get on and get almost any publication that I want. And I love the librarians at the American Museum of Natural History. So if there's something that they have, when they have almost everything, that is not online, they'll scan it for me. You know? It takes an email. And they're just wonderful. They'll do it. So I don't, you know, I developed back problems a couple of years ago. And it's not convenient for me to walk around. It's certainly not to browse, you know, the stacks at the library or anything like that. It's much easier for me to sit here and get on the computer and look at the catalog and say, geez, I don't see this, and what's up with that? I mean, the South African Journal of Science, they're not on JSTOR yet. Well, it's probably an apartheid hangover sort of political thing. I don't know. But there's papers by Elizabeth Verba and other people over there that I was trying to get a hold of to write my book. So I dragged into the museum and I found reprints, so I was able to handle it. But I told our librarian about that. He says, oh, we got to do something about that. You know, so. Yeah. I think he's on the JSTOR committee or whatever. So that's something that should be there. You know, so it's amazing what's grown on the internet since I started that book project. But anyway.
The book project you started in 95, you mean? Or
no, the one that I started in 3 years ago, this last one. I found Lamarck 1801 on it, and the French government had put it up. And but there's a lot of things I couldn't get. Now, the explosion has been tremendous in the last couple of years of what's there. It's virtually everything's there. We used to have I guess it still goes on. At the museum, the library would put out in a back private room that staff could go and see all the journals that came in the last week. I know people personally, not naming any names, who would spend a lot of time down there just looking at all of it. It's just, what the heck, you know? And, but starting at least 20 years ago, I just say to some of my younger colleagues, tell me if you see anything that's you think is that I have to look at. Otherwise, you know, yeah, so. It just hit me yesterday that with these three books all basically being finished, more or less at the same time, I hope. Because my wife's been saying, what are you going to do? I'm worried about you. And I said, oh, don't worry about it. You know, so, but no, it hit me yesterday. So what am I going to do? I have a tradition, at least in the old days, of finishing a book, for just one book, and then basically coasting for a while and letting the engines rev up, you know, and maybe write some papers and stuff. I don't do that anymore. So I'm not worried.
I think this is perfect.
Okay.
Thanks for talking with me.
Oh, well, thanks for coming out.
It was a blast.
It was fun. It was fun.
And that was my interview with Dr. Niles Eldridge. As you heard, he's coming out with a few new books, so we look forward to having him on the show again. If you missed any part of this show or want to share it with friends, visit our website at equaltimeforfreethought.org. And remember to tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.